South Florida Theater League and 91.3 WLRN offer same-day, half-price tickets at leading regional theaters and cultural organizations, including Slow Burn Theater, City Theater, Plaza Theater, and Broward Stage Door Theater. Information and a complete list of shows online at culturalconnection.org. Culturalconnection.org, your ticket to the cultural arts.
And it is today's topical occurrence. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman. How are you this afternoon, Bonnie?
I'm doing good. Looking forward to talking with Augustine.
Certainly an interesting man.
Yes.
Well, this hour we begin with author Augustine Burroughs. His latest book is This Is How, Surviving What You Think You Can't. Somehow We Get By. Augustine Burroughs joins us from New York City. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, Augustine. Pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Three of the strongest messages in your book are to find the truth underlying the truth, to live in this moment, and to focus on the present, not to be a victim of one's past. Do you still struggle in any of those areas today?
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I came to those realizations by, of course, doing exactly the opposite.
Right.
You know, spending a great deal of my adolescence just being furious at my father, or, you know, various injustices that I felt, you know, had been inflicted upon me, you know, so I was a victim, and I was very angry as a teenager, and, you know, I grew up, I mean, I talked about this in Running with Scissors, you know, my mother was mentally ill and couldn't raise me, and she gave me away as a child to her psychiatrist, who was very untraditional. He eventually lost his license to practice medicine, but I was raised in an environment without school and where there was no adult in my world that was sane or reasonable to whom I could go for advice. So whenever I had a problem or an issue, I had to figure it out myself. And that's really the origin of the book. I mean, after all these years, it's just that I'm someone who I tend to fix myself. And, you know, if my brain is broken in a certain area, I do tend to, you know, tinker at it and till I find a solution. So, you know, these are still things that I think I struggle with and everybody struggles with, but to a much, lesser extent than I ever did.
Right.
What's broken right now?
What's broken right now, you know, it's what it really is. There are certain things in my life that I don't pay them the mind that they deserve. You know, I've never been financially responsible in terms of, like, you know, putting every saving money or, you know, value. I'm just bad with money. I'm bad with it. And I'm not organized, you know, in terms of my scheduling of things. And those are the reason for that is just because I just don't do it. You know, it's not that there's anything I need to get over there. It's just I don't do it because I'm doing other things. And, you know, part of it comes down to, as well, learning to tell, you know, part of being honest with yourself is learning to sort of tell the difference between what you want and what you just really wish you wanted. I mean, I have a friend who, you know, she's been on a diet for as long as I've known her, you know, many, 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 many years. And if you're on a diet after 20 years, you know, and it's just not failed, that's when you have to ask yourself, is it that it really matters to you to be, you know, quote unquote thin? Or is it that you wish it really mattered, you know? And the answer can sometimes be infuriating because a person may really, really want to be something, you know. They may really want and wish to want to be thin, but not actually enough and not more than whatever it is that they enjoy that, you know, is blocking the way to thin. I mean, maybe people like cheese or cupcakes or whatever it is. And just realizing that about yourself is tremendously freeing. But again, like I said, it's not like you have that epiphany one day and you feel free and, you know, stress-free, because you can have to face something in yourself that you may wish were, in fact, you know, not the case. But if it is, it is.
You spend a great deal of time in your book on food addictions on both sides of the issue, and your methods for dealing with the addictions are rather novel and pretty unorthodox. Tell us about some of them, like your prescription if you had an anorexic child. I found that really interesting and kind of fascinating what you would have done.
Well, you know, I was actually not going to write about eating disorders, anorexia. You know, I don't have it, and I don't have kids, so I sort of felt like, well, who am I to talk about this?
Right.
But it was, I have friends who are impacted by this disease, and, you know, when I finally put it down and decided, you know what, I'm just not going to write about it, the moment I sort of released myself from that thought, well, I knew exactly what I would do if I had a child or a daughter or son who had an eating disorder and, you know, the therapies had not helped. I knew what I would do. And I have to sort of, before I explain what it is I would do, I have to say that, you know, there needs to be a lot more research in this area. And what I put in the book, I threw out there into the world hoping someone would research it, because the current therapies, food journals, these things don't work. And I couldn't find any research anywhere in my studies to, all the sort of treatment programs have food journals and, you know, a lot of very sort of group therapy, but I can't find a single sort of ground zero source that justifies that treatment. I think what it is that I think anorexia is a spectrum disorder. I think it's related to autism. I think it's a hypersensitivity to the perception of control. So if push came to shove and I had there was no cure, there's no successful treatment, I would give my child a credit card and I would, with their college tuition on it, and I would say, go. You're going to make every decision. You're on your own. I don't want to hear what's happening. And it would be horrible to do that, and I would feel like a monster. But here's the reason I would do it. If you told me you were going to kill yourself today, and you knew it, tonight you were going to do it, and then I gave you a magic sleeping pill that knocked you out for 18 hours, and I put you on a flight to India or Sri Lanka, and you woke up, I don't believe you would kill yourself that night, because as soon as you got off the plane, there would be so much overstimulation, colors you'd never seen before, smells, you know, where do you find a restroom? Why does the restroom look so different? And I think you'd be so overloaded that you just have to get your bearings. And that's not to say that the next night you wouldn't remain suicidal or the night after that. But if you can buy one little window, you know, you can pry that window open. And I think that, you know, a great deal of anorexia is connected, obviously, to control and a feeling of lack of control.
Right.
So what if you gave someone too much control, all the control?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that's necessarily the thing to do.
Right.
But I think it's definitely the thing to research.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or question, we're speaking with Augustine Burroughs about his book, This Is How, Surviving What You Can't, What You Think You Can't, at number 1-800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576, email radio at WLRN.org, Twitter at
Topical Currents.
Topical Currents. Augustine, you talk quite a bit about suicide in the book. Tell us of your thoughts and attempts, and you say it doesn't really bring peace.
Well, no, because peace, as well as joy and regret and comfort, these are all emotions that require neural activity to experience. You have to be alive to feel peace, and I was struggling with suicide. I had decided to kill myself as a young teenager because I felt that, you know, there was no way that I would ever have a chance to live a normal life given my living situation, my circumstances. But when I sort of deeply, deeply thought it through, I realized that the act, the method that I had chosen was not going to certainly provide any relief. It was going to be, you know, painful, involving a knife, and this was going to be very, very shocking. I've never seen blood like that before. So the brain, being wired for novel, which is to say new, unseen, original stimulation. If I'm in a bathtub and I slip my wrists, all of a sudden there's crimson water. That's going to be stunning. I'm not just going to pass out. I'm going to be alarmed, and that's going to make my blood, my heart pump, and the blood flow faster and faster. And I realize that I'm going to just be adding this layer of sort of gore and horror to the depression. I mean, here's the thing. If the act of suicide, if the swallowing of the pill or the tightening of the noose, if these things did provide relief or peace, a sense of relief or peace, everyone would stop midway because the body is just genetically designed. We are created to live and to fight to live. It's difficult, you know. It's difficult to end one's life. Your body fights against you. And that's when I realized something that I think a lot of people don't realize, that it's not that I wanted to kill myself. It was that I wanted to end my life. And there's a huge difference because I never really realized before that I could step out of this life. I mean, I grew up in this town. My mother was ill, my father, and this was her psychiatrist, and these were his kids and patients, and this whole world in which I lived, it was tiny. I mean, it felt big, and it felt like, well, this, you know, our life is what we know. Our life is the world, but in fact, it's not. It's tiny, tiny, tiny. And I realized I could step out the door barefoot if I had to. And instead of making a right, I could make a left. I could get on a bus. I could get on a container ship. It didn't matter where. And would my life be better? Maybe. Maybe it would be worse. Maybe it would be similar. Maybe it would be the same, but I would be alive. So the difference is ending one's life versus killing oneself. And that's a distinction. It sounds like semantics, but it's not. It's a very, very profound distinction that people really need to be made aware of. You know, when we talk about kids who are suicidal in the media, I just again and again and again, I hear exactly the same advice. If you have a child or you know a child who's suicidal, please encourage them to talk to someone they can trust, a figure, you know, from their church or someone from school that they trust. But that's very bad advice because it just passes the buck. What is this person going to say that you don't know what to say? I mean, no one really knows what to say to kids who want to kill themselves, you know, and right. We just sort of pass the buck around and hope that someone with an advanced degree knows what to say. And I think the thing to say is when you think about it, suicide isn't going to work because you're not going to be alive to feel that peace. And all the anger you feel, you're not going to be alive to watch the suffering of those you left behind. I mean, that's a terrible thing to say, but part of the motivation in some people for killing themselves is revenge, is to hurt people that they feel have hurt them. And, you know, certainly it's not terribly noble, it's understandable, but you're not going to have that either. I mean, there will be whatever discomfort created by your method of choice for suicide, whether it's sort of, you know, upset or pain in the stomach or physical wounds or, you know, whatever, asphyxiation. There's going to be that layered on top of the despair or anger or misery that you felt that brought you to that stage. And then literally that's the end. That's it. You don't exist in the world. The world has gone on. You are, that's it. So it's a myth. We romanticize suicide, you know, and people say, oh, well, she looked so peaceful in the coffin. Actually though, not. People don't look peaceful when they're dead. They look gone. They look like meat. You know, that's not peaceful. They don't look like they're sleeping. So, yeah, that was an important thing for me to write about. I mean, it's not a funny topic, of course, you know, and I'm known for funny stuff, but I just felt this after writing so many books about myself and having a lot of them be very funny. I just felt like I've been so deeply moved by the, you know, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people I've met over the years as an author. I've been so touched. It's made me more human, and I just can't stand the idea of people struggling with some of the things that I have struggled with that I don't struggle with now. And especially when I know, look, this is how you need to think about it, or at least this, when I thought about it this way, it freed me from it. So that was really sort of also the inspiration behind, you know, putting the book out there in the first place.
And you researched the area of self-help before writing your book and didn't like much what you found. Was it wanting to share these things, your compassion for others, that motivated you to write the book?
You know, I did. I researched, you know, specifically confidence, because one of the things that I've been told again and again when after, you know, like I'm speaking at a college or at an event, young people frequently will come up to me and talk about how confident I am. And, you know, that's something that I've heard since I was a teenager when I got into advertising, you know, very, very young as a teenager, and I had no problem at all standing up in front of the board of director of Coca-Cola and, you know, talking to them about whatever it was I wanted to do. And I guess that's confidence, right? Apparently I have it, and I had it then, and I had a lot of it. So I've studied myself, you know, on my mental laboratory tray. What is it, this thing that I have? You know, people want more confidence. So I read about sort of how authors, self-help authors specifically, position confidence. How do they sell it, you know, to the world? And then, you know, usually there's 3 to 7 steps. Part of it is, you know, admitting the things you're good at and reminding yourself of your successes. And I just thought, that's terrible, because that's completely false. People are wasting their money. You know, confidence, you can't go to the doctor and get your blood confidence level checked. You know, it's this thing you want more of. Well, first you have to define it. What is it? I mean, the fact is, speaking as a confident person, there is no thing in me that's extra. I don't have this confidence fluid. You know, there is no such thing. Confidence is a word that exists in the observer. And it's a word that's used to describe a certain quality that one observes in another person. And that quality is a focus of the moment. The person is being themselves, doing the thing that they're actually doing in the moment that they're doing it. I mean, years ago when Steven Jobs introduced, I think it was the iPhone to the world, maybe the iPad, but the iPhone, I think, when he introduced it to the world, it didn't work. It just, like, he pushed a button and it didn't work. A little malfunction. He made a joke and everyone laughed and everyone loved him and everyone bought the phone. But imagine if he'd stepped outside the moment and thought, because, you know, making a joke in a situation like that is what you would do if you were home alone. But imagine if you sort of stepped outside what you were doing and thought about them. How does this look? Oh, no, what are the shareholders going to say? We've spent so much money on R&D, and if this product is now failing in front of a mass audience, this is terrible. You know, you've departed the moment. Confidence is gone. There's no such thing. Confidence is really, to get more confidence, you need to care a great deal less about what other people are thinking. You have to not let your mind travel outside of the moment, specifically the thing you're doing in the moment. And you literally have to not worry about it. You have to not think about it. You have to stop yourself. You have to block yourself from asking, do I look confident? Do I look good doing this? Because, you know, confidence has nothing to do with competence. You can be terrible at something and still be very confident when you're doing it. So those were, you know, some of the sort of fallacies that I saw in the world of, you know, self-improvement that I thought, well, this needs to stop. I mean, it's ridiculous for someone to spend money on a book when confidence is a thing that you can easily, you know, achieve the thing people call confidence. You can practice it. You can really practice not letting yourself wonder what they're thinking, wonder how you look.
You give a good example. I mean, I loved your little thing about what you did to start the ball rolling on not caring what other people thought. Yeah, really. But sometimes we have to care what other people think, like such in a job. What about for those who have to care?
Well, it's not about not caring what someone thinks. It's about, I mean, because you don't want to, you know, it's not to confuse it with sort of a lack of empathy or a lack of understanding. If you've been hired in a job to do a certain thing, that's what you need to be focused on. Not whether they think you're doing it well or not, but doing the thing that you're paid to do as good as you can without the interruption and distraction of wondering if you're doing okay. You've got to sort of have faith that if you're not, someone's going to tell you, you know? Someone's going to say something.
Right.
So it's not that you're not listening to people. It's that you're not wondering if they're judging you.
Mm-hmm.
They're not, you know, if you're a waiter or a waitress and you plop down, you know, the order, you know, you can't stand there and think about, well, am I doing this, you know, did I get this on time enough? Do you think they're going to tip me enough? You know, all those distracting out of self thoughts, those mm-hmm. have nothing to do with reality. And, you know, so it's about not thinking other people's thoughts, you know, for
right.
them, not inserting your head into theirs. But absolutely listening to other people. In fact, it's essential to listen to other people, because when someone is speaking to you, it can be very easy to think you know what they're saying and to start immediately going, yeah, yeah, uh-huh, and waiting to insert your question or, you know, comment or, you know, your mind drifts. But when you actually listen, you know, you lose yourself. So that it's, you have to really kind of be in your interactions on a daily basis. You've really got to be fresh, fresh, like fresh homemade bread every second of the day. I mean, that's the goal, you know, that's the goal.
Augustine Burroughs, you changed your name at age 18.
Mm-hmm.
Why and why Augustine Burroughs?
Well, I did change it at 18 because I didn't want to be, I was born Chris Robeson, and I didn't want to have the name. I wanted to be a different person. I didn't want to be the person who had gone through, you know, the experience with my alcoholic father and mentally ill mother and growing up in this crazy environment. I wanted to start over. I wanted completely to have a new life. And, you know, I was 18, so it seemed like, well, changing my name, I'll just reinvent myself. And, you know, for the newness of it, it certainly, you know, was fun. And it did help. But, of course, you know, all the things I was running away from, you can't ever run away from. You know, they run right after you. And if they see you running, they'll just run faster. So I ended up, you know, with this name. And why Augustine? You know, it just, Burroughs was an old family name. And Augustine sounded sort of classic, but unfamiliar.
Kind of Roman.
You think you've heard it, but not quite. It's a little more modern because it's not Augustine, it's Augustine. So it was, it just, I liked it, you know. And then my middle name is X-O-N. And, you know, I was studying computer programming at the time, and back then, I don't know if it's still the same, but computers used to be either X on or X off, and X on meant you were in a state of accepting input, and I thought, what a perfect middle name, like a fulcrum, you know, always accepting input. So that's the story.
Augustine, you seem pretty ambivalent. I know you've had a lot of therapy, and but in the book, you seem ambivalent about the value of therapy and therapists. I guess there are some good ones, some bad ones. Where do you stand on that now?
Well, I do. I think that, you know, I mean, there are good ones and there are bad ones. I think a good therapist, you know, is going to be someone who is completely professional. You don't want to be friends with your therapist. You don't want to be pals with your therapist. A therapist, a really excellent therapist, you know, has training, first of all, but they are good at pattern recognition, and they can identify or observe patterns in your behavior that you're not aware of, and they can point those out to you, and, you know, they can sort of show you or point you away from going down sort of psychological dead ends. But people need to be aware that therapy is a business. It's a business just like any other business. And any smart, successful business person wants to have a lot of their customers come back again and again and again and again. So the therapy sort of treatment modality is not set up in mind with speed, you know, necessarily, or even efficacy in mind. It's you know, a commitment to one's self. But that's ad speak, really. I mean, that's ad speak. And it of course, it's also like ad speak. In many cases, it's also true. It is a commitment to oneself. So, you know, I think it depends on, you know, if it's something that you enjoy and you're actually experiencing progress, then there's no reason, you know, if you can afford it, not to remain in therapy for, you know, a long time if it's useful to you. But, you know, it's not necessary. It's not always necessary. And I think there are some things for which therapy is absolutely necessary. I mean, anger is one example, because anger is something that people, you know, it's a very frightening emotion. And, you know, it is an emotion just like every other. It's not, you know, something abnormal, and it's not something that's a flaw. People feel anger for, you know, a biological reason. But because we repress it as a culture, it can come out in explosive and deadly ways. So I've always felt that, you know, if you've got anger issues, you definitely want to be sitting across from somebody in a white jacket with a clipboard because it's scary, you know. But for things, you know, there's a lot of things that people can get over themselves. And, you know, even in therapy, really, you are the one doing the work. You know, and a therapist
right.
should be reminding you that at all times. So it's not that I'm against therapy. It's that I think you need to have someone who's very good at it. You know, sometimes people enter the field of therapy because they themselves suffer from psychological issues that they want to understand, you know, and they're crazy and they want to figure themselves out.
Exactly.
And there's no way to actually identify, you know, which person is which. So you need to find recommendations from people that, you know, you think pretty much to the best of their ability, have it together. If you've got a friend who seems to, you know, sure, they have problems and such, but they also, you know, they work on them and they get through things, and you see their life has progress, that's someone you'd want to ask if, you know, they have a recommendation.
Well, I guess we're just about out of time, Augustine Burroughs. One thing you say truth is an opinion. It's a force of it's not an opinion. It's a force like gravity. And I found it to be the bedrock of your book, and you say it's how we survive the unthinkable. And we want to thank you so much for joining us today, and good luck with the book.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
Okay, thank you.
Food and Dining is next. And we return on this Thursday afternoon in South Florida. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, one of our favorite segments each year, Bonnie.
Indeed.
Mango Madness. We've got them all in front of us. Various aromas in the air. And, of course, we're joined now by chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. Linda will be enjoying the best today.
We are so lucky today. Yes.
Exotic ones.
Right. Well, our, as you mentioned, our annual Mango Madness show. Have you noticed, Joe and Bonnie, that the mangoes have been dropping off the trees for over a month now?
Is it an early season?
It's been an early harvest.
We've had some bags of them show up in the employees' lounge here.
Oh, you are. And you didn't share them?
Yeah.
Hello.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, I love eating a ripe mango. It's perfect when it's just picked and it's still warm from the sun. We're so lucky here in South Florida that we can do that. Well, our guests today are here to tell us about the types of mangoes we find in our backyards, the best eating mangoes, and they're going to give us some mango history. So Dr. Richard Campbell is Director of Horticulture at Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden. And welcome, Richard.
Great to be here.
Every year we love
having
every
year.
Yes, every year, right. And also with us is Norris Ledesma. She's the curator of tropical fruits at Fairchild. Welcome, Norris.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Thank you.
Great to have you with us. And we'd love to have you, our listeners, join us too. Are you overloaded with backyard fruit? Or maybe you need some advice about your mango trees? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. WLRN.
Email radio at WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents.
All right, give us a tweet. Also with us, our favorite wine guy, Fred Tasker. He's joining us by Skype, and you can read Fred's Wine Suggestions for My Dinner in Minutes column and also his wine column. They're both in today's Miami Herald. Fred, are we drinking today?
Mangoes and wine, that's a heavenly combination.
You always say wine with anything's a heavenly combination.
Well, you can leave out the everything sometimes.
Except hot dogs, maybe.
Hot dogs go with expensive champagne.
Oh, all right. Well, maybe we'll be talking about that next week. Well,
why not?
Okay, Richard Campbell, it's been this unusual mango year, early harvest. So what can we expect throughout the summer?
Well, unfortunately, we can expect for... pretty much our mango season has occurred.
And it's finished?
It's finished. And
oh, no.
What we now have is going to be a second bloom, but a very small bloom. So we're going to have a long, hot, mango-less summer, actually. Mango Festival at Fairchild Garden is going to be the last hurrah for our mango season. We're going to be all in, all done after that.
But you've got enough for the festival.
We'll have enough for the festival, but it's going to be it's really going to be people's last chance.
And why was it so early this year?
We had an early bloom. We had an early cold in October that caused the mangoes to bloom in November, and then that crop ripened over a month ago. And then they forced out a late bloom, but that came off in May. And the late bloom always sets very little and has to go through a lot of weather, and it has a lot of problems. So we will have fruit, but there will be a very limited amount. Mm. And so mangoes are going to be worth their weight in gold this summer, in other words.
Wow, you keep tempting everyone with this, with coming to the festival. So the festival is going to be July 13th?
July 13th and 14th at Fairchild Garden in Coral Gables. And literally, we're gonna blow it out there. That's going to be the last chance for people to be eating and seeing all these great mangoes.
Now you've got,
you know, what I've always done to extend the mango season is to make mango puree and put it in ice cube trays. And then you have it for the rest of the year, and you can make wonderful mango daiquiris that way.
Okay, thanks for that tip, Fred. That's very good. And I want you to know we've got all these mangoes to taste here in the studio. Bonnie just got out of her chair to go and eat all of these.
I just Tebowed.
Yeah. Is that named after Tim Tebow?
It actually is.
It is. It is good. It tastes a little like, there's a little coconut in it.
I want everyone to know that that's the name of the mango.
Why is it named after him?
It was named by a local nurseryman. It was named after Tim Tebow when he was going through the whole craze was, he's a Gator graduate, and so he named it. And it was selected by the University of Florida, so it's apropos.
It tastes kind of holy.
It is. It's quite holy. Yeah, yes, absolutely.
Yes. All right. From there, let's go to line one.
Wait a minute. Okay.
Okay. Stop eating there. Leo in Hollywood, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi. How are you?
Good. You have a question?
I do. First off, I wanted to follow up on what you said about how they're dropping so early, the mangoes. My neighbor's tree is dropped all of them, and I was very surprised to see it this early in the season because I'm much more used to seeing them in as late as, September, October sometimes. But I just started trying to grow mango trees from the pit. And I'm wondering if there's... I'm not having a lot of luck. They're not even sprouting.
Anybody
know? Do they have some special...
Can you grow mango from the pit? I mean, I see them all the time because I leave the tree drops and the squirrels get them and the pits in the soil, and they start to sprout. So
this is not the best way to propagate mangoes anyway, because if you propagate mangoes from seeds, you don't know what you are going to get. So basically, the recommendation will be to get mangoes that have been grafted. That will be the best choice
To buy the tree that's been grafted. So he's having a
hard time.
Because
it may be a hybrid seed or something?
Yes, I always said that no matter how beautiful your mother is and how handsome your father could be, surprises you can get. So that's basically my philosophy with that.
Leo, I don't know if that's the answer you wanted. That's the fun of it. All right, well, keep trying then.
All right.
Okay, and Felix in St. Augustine. Hello, Felix.
Yes, good morning. Good afternoon. How are you all doing?
Excellent.
Fine. You have a question.
Yes, I live in St. Augustine, Florida, and I was just wondering, is that area, would it be too cold to have a mango tree in St. Augustine, you think?
You could do it, but you would have to grow a mango you'd have to grow it in a container and be able to cover it up during 2 to 3 weeks during the winter. So the only way you could really do it would be grow it in a container, maybe have casters on the container that you could move around so you could cover it up or move it inside during really bad cold. But otherwise, you're outside the zone where you could grow mango. Furthest north on the East Coast is Merritt Island, is as close as you could do. But that's on Merritt Island where you can do it.
Okay.
One more question. I have two huge magnolia trees on my property. Do the mangoes have to be in direct sunlight all the time?
Yes.
Okay. Well, good
they
luck.
They need the sun and they need the warmth. Thanks for your call. Let's get on with some of these mangoes that we've got tasting here. I've got here one called a diamond, and what am I tasting here, Norris?
The diamond is a Fairchild Tropical Garden selection, and we have been trying this mango for the past 3 years. Has been a success so far. We are recommending this mango because it makes a perfect tree for a backyard.
Boy, it's diamond. Mm, it's delicious.
Delicious.
We're all, I'm sorry, everyone, but we are gorging ourselves here. And we can't stop eating these mangoes. Mm. And what have you got over there near you, Bonnie?
I have something called Bonalia.
Bonilejo.
Bonilejo. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's a J. Okay,
all right, so what is she eating there?
Bonilejo, it's a selection from the Dominican Republic. It's coming from Bani. And it's a wonderful mango that is super sweet. They love it. Every single person in the Dominican Republic has connection with this mango.
And now, you've just come back, Norris, from the Dominican Republic. You're sort of exchanging mangoes back and forth. We're giving some there, and they're giving some to us. Is that
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely. As part of Fairchild Tropical Garden, we are helping the growers. So we are collecting mangoes all over the places in the tropics, in the Americas, and Asia, and South Asia. But as part of our interchange, we are helping the growers as well.
You know, I remember that at the festival, you always have people from all over the world. Do you have the usual 100 nations of mangoes this year?
Yes, we actually do. We're going to do a grower summit, and we have a large contingent coming from Myanmar. We have people from Mexico, because this year's theme are the mangoes of Mexico. And we also have many people from Haiti. We're going to have Ghanaians. As usual, we will be very international.
Right. Okay, so what other? We have some mangoes still. We have there's several on the table.
We have coconut cream.
Oh, the coconut cream one. What's that called? Coconut cream? Is that what the name?
Yeah,
of
that's why it tastes. That's why it's called coconut cream, because it tastes like coconut cream. actually, no, that's
reason.
The truth. That's the truth. That comes from one of our friends in Boynton Beach, and it's an excellent flavored mango. I also have next to me. I actually have a Lalajiwo, which is actually a mangiferous species, so it's not Mangifera indica. And that is also called the honey mango, and it tastes just like honey to me. Although, Linda, you were telling me that you didn't agree, but, you know, it's okay. It's okay to disagree, Linda. It's all right.
Well, everyone has a different taste, but I think we decided that it had already gotten a little overripe.
Right, right.
And so for me, it was tasting a little different. But all these mangoes, that's the beauty of the Mango Festival, is that you get to taste all these different types of mangoes and see what they're like. Now, but for those of you who buy a mango in a supermarket, what are we buying?
When you're buying mangoes in a supermarket, about 65% of the mangoes imported in the United States come from Mexico. And the rest come from Peru, Brazil, Nicaragua.
Why wouldn't they be from Florida?
We just basically can't produce enough mangoes to feed the United States anymore. We can't even become close. So when you do buy these mangoes, you're buying varieties that were selected in Florida.
And that travel well.
And that travel well and that are beautiful and they store well. Mm. And so those were Tommy Atkins, Hayden, Kit, Kent, and Atahualpa, which is actually a Mexican variety.
Okay, well, it's so delicious. But we need to take a break. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. As you can imagine, we're talking about mangoes with Dr. Richard Campbell and Norris Ledesma. They're both from Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more.
Imagine, if you will, sultry summer Miami afternoon. Everyone arriving home from work, all is quiet, till the air is rent by a startled cry. Watch out, that man's got a mango. He's got a mango. He's got a mango. He's got so many mangoes, he don't know what to do. He's gonna put them in a shopping bag and give them to you. You got mangoes. You got mangoes. You got your mango chutney, mango pie, and mangoes to freeze. You got your midnight mango madness making daiquiris. Out of mangoes. Out of mangoes. But whatever you do, don't give your mangoes to me. Cause I got a mango tree. I got mango.
Well, you get the idea. That's Grant Livingston, South Florida's own. The song Watch Out, That Man's Got Mangoes. Thanks for Michael Stock for getting that for us.
Very cute.
Very cute.
And they even mentioned daiquiris, friend.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, how about that?
Well, as you can imagine, we've been talking about mangoes and about mango madness with Dr. Richard Campbell. He's the director of horticulture at Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden. And Norris Ledesma is curator of tropical fruit at Fairchild. They've been giving us some tips on how to grow, pick, and we've been eating lots of mangoes. The Fairchild Garden Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden Mango Festival is scheduled for July 13th and 14th. And for more information, you can go to Fairchild Garden.
Heavily attended, isn't it?
Yes. My advice to you, it starts at 9:30. Get there early. Get there very early. And also, a special production.
And you can buy trees. And
everything you want to do with mangoes. You can taste everything, eat everything, buy everything, and buy trees, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So then you can grow your own mangoes in your yard.
All right.
And you bring your children as well, because we have a wonderful program for the whole family.
Okay.
Sounds great. Well, Viva Mango, that's a production of WLRN. It shows how mangoes play an important role in the lives of this community, and it covers some of the Mango Festival from last year. And our two people here are stars in the program, Richard Campbell and Norris Ledesma.
Wow, I didn't know we had stars here.
Yes, they're going to be there. Well, check your schedule for the timing. They're going to start airing July 10th. That's at 8 p.m. July 11th. At 10 p.m., July 12th at 7:30, July 13th at 8 p.m. There'll be several chances to see the program. And I also understand it's going to be at the festival itself. It's going to be shown there as well.
Correct, yes.
Yes, but check your schedule for the timing. It'll be a lot of fun. All right, so it's dinner in minutes time. And guess what? It's a mango steak fest. It's a mango dinner in minutes. Steak with mango salsa and a quick brown rice salad. So really, it's very simple. You sauté the steak, and you top it with the mango salsa. So you cut the mango into small cubes. And, you know, an easy way for me that I cut mangoes is I just cut them in half around the side of each of the seed, and I scoop it out with a spoon, one big cheek of it, and then cut it into smaller pieces. But there are many other ways. And I mixed it with some honey and some lime juice, cilantro, a little chopped jalapeno pepper. And then you just sprinkle that over the cooked steak. It's very good.
All right.
And for the brown rice salad, get some quick cooking brown rice or microwavable brown rice. Toss in some defrosted peas, some olive oil, salt and pepper, and that's your meal. That complete recipe is at my website. That's dinnerinminutes.com with a photo. And my dinner in minutes in today's Miami Herald is dilled salmon parcels with parsley and rice. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. And Fred, is it daiquiris today?
Well, not necessarily, no. I actually remember very fondly the time that Richard and his crew invited me to the Mango Festival to give a talk on what kind of wine goes with mangoes. And, of course, the research for this was lots of fun. Turns out there are all kinds of different wines that go with mangoes. I learned to make a green mango salad with unripe mangoes and rice wine vinegar and green Thai chilies. So, of course, this was a crisp tart salad, so a crisp tart Sauvignon Blanc went with it very nicely. You might get one from Matanzas Creek in California. Of course, the best way to eat mangoes is just a simple plate of sliced super ripe mangoes all by themselves. And if you have that, one of the sweeter versions of Gewürztraminer is a wonderful combination. Sutter Home makes one that's kind of medium sweet and go very nicely. Or even better, you might drive out to Schnebeli's winery in the Redland right here in Dade County and buy a bottle of his Mango Dolce sweet wine. Mango wine with mangoes, you can't go wrong.
That sounds good.
Of course, with today's dinner in minutes, steak with mango salsa, you'd want a red wine. But you'd want a fruity one like the Pinot Noir from McMurray Ranch rather than a big, powerful, tannic Cabernet Sauvignon or something like that. And finally, when Linda's favorite time of the meal arrives, which is what, Linda?
I guess
dessert,
you know.
Right?
Yes. Oh, Fred, how do you know?
Oh, yeah. Mangoes and wine absolutely shine together in desserts. I just looked up a recipe for a mango flan. It just sounded wonderful, light and sweet and just spectacular. And with that, I would serve a dessert wine, maybe a late harvest Riesling from Hoag Cellars in Washington State or something like that.
Sounds good to me, Fred.
Of course, Linda's never happy until there's chocolate, so let me make a kind of off-the-wall
suggestion. You're
giving
me a bad reputation.
Yes, you do. You certainly do. Well, so what you do, Linda, you make a nice sweet mango cobbler, and you serve it with a dessert beer.
Oh, wow.
Like a chocolate stout from Rogue Brewery in Oregon. Richard, did you ever have beer with mangoes?
He grimaced when you talked about it.
Well, I was still stuck on the light flan. That was the one that got me. I was thinking, well, okay. No, I haven't. I have not.
Fred, what's a chocolate beer?
Yeah.
Well, they make it in a couple of ways. One of the breweries actually puts Godiva chocolate in the beer.
Wow.
And it tastes exactly like Godiva chocolate.
I'm going to take you up on this, Fred, because, you know, I always try the ones you recommend, and you're always right. So I'm
going
with that.
Well, Richard, report back next year, will you?
I definitely will.
Okay, don't give him a big head about this always right thing, okay?
And what's the name of the brewery, Fred?
Rogue, R-O-G-U-E.
Okay.
That's a big brewery. They make a lot of really excellent beers.
All right. Well, we only have a short half minute left, but someone's asking on the phone, how do you get, can you have a tree produce mangoes year-round? Is that possible?
No. it's just the problem is you can have trees that will produce fruit at different seasons, but they'll never produce year-round. That's the real problem. They just can't do it. Physiologically, a mango tree can't do that.
But you can extend the season having different mangoes than produce mangoes in a different time. And with our mangoes, you can extend the season for 5 months.
Yeah. Okay, so if you a different variety, if you want to plant different varieties to know what... it'll go through maybe
That's
five,
correct.
6 months.
That's
different
correct.
Mangoes. Yes.
Correct.
Now, the festival is July...
13th and 14th.
13th and 14th.
And if you plant a little tree, I know we have... Okay, we have to go. I want to know how long it took to bloom.
Come back for Mango Festival. We have all these answers.
Okay.
Okay, it's been an extraordinarily tasty week. Talking with you, Dr. Richard Campbell. Thank you. Director of Horticulture at Fairchild Tropical Botanic Garden, and Norris Ledesma, Curator of Tropical Fruit. Really, thank you so much for all
Indeed.
These delicious
thank
mangoes.
You.
Thank
My
you.
Pleasure.
Their mango festival is July 13th through 14th. Get there early for the best tastes. And thank you. You ate well today.
Excellent.
Didn't you, Joe
yes.
yes. and Bonnie?
Yes, we did.
And Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Next week, for our July 4th program, we'll be talking with Bruce Craig, the author of Man Bites Dog. Hot dogs. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up our program today. Our producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction from Caroline Brader Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. Also, thanks to Michael Stock. Of course, we have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org. Also, more information at the Topical Currents Facebook page. See pictures of Linda and Bonnie. Tomorrow at 1, it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. Another super live in-studio concert. Don't miss it. Bonnie and I return Monday. And an all-movie calendar for June 20th. On this day in 1909, 104 years ago, the birth of actor Errol Flynn in Tasmania. He died at age 50. Eight of his swashbuckler films co-starred Olivia de Havilland. And on this day in 1924, 89 years ago, the birth of super war hero and actor Audie Murphy in Kingston, Texas. A fifth-grade dropout, his best film was for John Huston in Red Badge of Courage. After JFK's, his gravesite is the most visited at Arlington National Cemetery. One more before we do the right thing. On this day in 1933, 80 years ago, the birth of actor Danny Aiello in New York. An ex-bouncer, he says he was once... a thief. Our theme music, created by Michael Levine. And so we leave with a thought from Errol Flynn, who was great friends of David Niven. Quote, "My problem lies in reconciling my gross habits with my net income." This is Joseph Cooper for Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.